Okay. We were talking about the ship.
Yeah.
And so you were not in steerage, is that right? Or you were, in a cabin?
We were in a cabin, and my mother, they had to go the cheapest route that they could, so she got two beds, one on the bottom and one on the top. And my sister, who was a year, slept with my mother, and I slept with my brother. They were very, very narrow. So before I even went to bed, I had to decide which side I was going to sleep on, because there was no way that I could turn to the other side during the night. And so that's how small it was. And of course, my mother had a tremendous problem, because the time change, and it got so by the end of the journey, the kids were waking up around 3 or 4 in the morning. They couldn't change the time, and I had to amuse my brother until the whole ship woke up, and it was really very difficult. And then, of course, they couldn't even be awake to have the supper, because they were already exhausted by 3 or 4 in the afternoon. Oh, my mother had, I'll tell you, it was not fun to be my mother. And so then we had these tables with the food, and the food was very good. A lot of the people would not even have a thing to eat, because they were seasick. They couldn't eat. So there'd probably be one person sitting at the whole table. And I helped the waiters to put the dishes out. That was one of my jobs, and I looked forward to that. So when we landed in New York, something happened to our ship, and we had to land before to have this hole repaired in the ship. And when we did, the waiters and the people who worked on the ship could leave into New York City, and they were delighted to go. So anyway, fellows went to New York, and when they came back, one of them brought me a huge bag of all kinds of fruit, because they knew I loved oranges and apples, because I spent every penny I got a hold of, I'd spend for an orange or an apple. And so I got this huge thing of fruit, and this was unusual for Scandinavia, because they could only raise apples and pears. That's about all they ever had. And so I looked at this one particular fruit, and I felt of it, and I said to my mother, "What is this?" It was a peach, and it was furry, and I said, "What do you think it has inside?" And my mother said, "Well, bite into it." So I bit into it, and the juice went down my chin. And when I bit some more, here was a stone inside, and I was just amazed at that. And so I've loved peaches ever since, of course, all fruit anyway. But there were bananas, there were oranges, and I think there was even a pineapple in there. And it was just, I never forgot it. It was so wonderful. And then on the gangplank, where the men would go up and down to reach the land, I noticed a man coming up, and I looked at him, and he had a black face. And I said to my mother, he has a black face. What is that?" She said, "Some people have black faces." I had never seen a Negro or a black man.
So what did you do with your candy bars?
We had gone a couple of days, and my mother was terribly seasick. And when we got into our cabin, all I could smell was that chocolate. It really made me nauseated. I thought, I just can't stand that smell. And, of course, it bothered my mother, and I knew it bothered my mother. She had to go and throw up into the container and all this stuff, and I thought, gosh, I can't do that. I probably had eaten one of them or something. But I said to my mother, "I don't know what to do with those." She says, "Throw them overboard." I threw them overboard.
Yeah. let's see. So you were in a cabin with your brother, sister, and mother. Was there anybody else in that cabin?
Yes, there were another. There were a man and a wife. They each had one of the. I think it was a man and a wife. I'm not really sure. It could have been two women, but we were never in with them. Well, they were probably upset because we were young kids and they were trying to be in this little tiny cabin. No one stayed in their cabin unless they had a private cabin. They were up sitting at the on top of the deck, and the music was wonderful. We enjoyed the music, and of course I had heard a lot of music through my father anyway, and the kids would run. My brother, he would run all over and busy himself with that, and I'm chasing him, and very active kind of living, and when you're that old, and. So that was, but it was a beautiful ship, and we had one bad storm where the plates would be moving, so they put them down, and everyone was, a lot of people were seasick. Nobody came for a meal, and so that was one of the things about going by ship at that time, seasickness.
Well, now, where was the music coming from?
I think they had a band. I think they had someone play. It probably was just an accordion and a piano or something. I mean, it wasn't like it is today. And they did, they might have had other little entertainments, but I really didn't get into that because I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, were there different, were you a third class passenger?
Yeah.
Then were there first and second class accommodations on the same ship?
Yeah. And the first class was up on the top, and we were never allowed to go there. But we some of the third class passengers were way, way down on the ship. You know, there were
In the steerage.
Yeah. So we were on one of the top ones, which wasn't too bad, but we had quite a few steps to go up and down to get down there. And, I don't remember looking out. I just remember sitting on the deck. And, of course, I remember the many days of not seeing anything but ocean and sky. That's an experience. And I remember when we started seeing land and we started seeing the Statue of Liberty. I remember that very vividly. Everybody got up on the top there and they're all, you know, everybody's feeling great because we arrived. You don't know when you're on a ship that you can you can drown. And so we arrived, and there was music played, and they played America, and I think it was America they played. And then shortly after that, we saw the Ellis Island thing, and we knew we were going to go there. And everybody was on that one side of the ship watching this stuff, you know. So we were very happy about it.
What did you know about Ellis Island before you actually went? Remember?
Well, the thing was, I asked my mother about, you know, what are we going to do and all this. And my mother said that they're going to examine us. And the one thing that I remember very clearly was that all the women, and there were quite a few Finnish people coming across with us at the same time. And we... the women sort of knew that they would be there, the hair of the children would be, the heads of the children would be examined, so they wanted to be sure that they had no lice. And so all the women were fine combing their kids, and my mother was fine combing me. I had long hair down to my waist, and she was fine combing me, and that's the reason why I heard her say that you have to be careful not to have picked out picked up any lice. So the women were really busy about that. They were also busy washing their children and you know, themselves, I imagine, so that they'd be clean, because they knew that they would be looked at, and they wanted to pass.
So what were your impressions of Ellis Island? Do you remember when
Ellis Island, we went on a boat, on a small boat from where the ship was, where the ship had landed, and we had the ride over to Ellis Island. Everybody was excited, and everybody had the best clothes that they had with them, they put on so that they would look nice. And we went in, the thing that I can remember about Ellis Island, and I have never visited there since then, was that it was a beautiful, beautiful building. And there was very many beams and carvings in the hall that we went in. We had a guide, and we would just follow the guide. And they made us go up those long stairs there. Mm-hmm. And of course, my mother was carrying the baby, and I'm carrying two suitcases and my brother, and because my mother she just couldn't manage everything. And so we trotted along up those stairs, and of course I got to know later that they did have guides up and down watching this, and they wanted to look at the people to see if they had anything wrong with their legs and that, and they were also looking at could you breathe properly in that, because of the TB thing that they had. And so we made it. Of course, my mother was very young, and so we made it up the stairs, and then I'm not sure if it was before we went to the stairs or after, but we sat in a dining room and we had something to eat, which was wonderful. We thought it was fabulous. We were starved. And so we had something to eat, and I can't really remember, but I know we had milk. But I don't know what else, maybe a bun or something. I don't know. But anyway, we sat at the examining table like this, and there was a man and an interpreter. They are asking us questions, and they would ask you about did you ever have TB, and something about the children, and they did kind of look at your hair a little bit. They probably could tell whether you were clean or not, you know. It wasn't a thorough thing, but when I sat downstairs before this event occurred, I looked at the what do you call the veranda?
The balcony.
And the people were walking there, and I said to my mother, why are those people up there? Who are they? And my mother said, well, if they don't pass, then they put them there. I said, Mom, don't let them put me up there. That's all I could think of, because I didn't say about this, but when my mother was buying the tickets to go overseas, I think that the man that was selling the tickets knew that there was a lot of poverty and things, and my mother didn't have any money and that, and he figured that maybe if they said I was 10 years old instead of 11, I could go for half price ticket. And so I was put down as 10 years old, and I knew about this because my mother told me, if anyone asks you how old you are, you say 10. And so I said, don't let them put me up there, because I felt that now they could tell that I was 11 and they were going to take me put me up there all by myself. And not only that, I had lost my father for 3 months. I already was all nervous about my father leaving, and I felt that maybe something happened that might, they'd take my mother and I'd be there with no one, you know. And so I had that, just like children, you can see where kids who are taken away from their families have fears of all kinds. You certainly learn that when these things happen to you. Well, he just looked at the records and everything, and then he said, okay. We were delighted.
So when did you meet up with your father?
Well, that was another horrible story, because when we got on the, of course, at Ellis Island, we heard all kinds of languages. There was all sorts of nationalities there. We weren't the only ones. And so we got on a little boat to go to the train station. And we took all our things. My mother checked to see that the trunk was there. And so we got on that boat, and then we landed, and that's when we were supposed to meet my father. He wasn't there. My mother was, she didn't say anything, but I know that she must have been tremendously nervous. And she thought, well, I'm going to go anyway. And we packed into the train for Worcester. And my mother couldn't figure out what happened to my father. We got to Worcester, to the Union Station. I look at that station and I remembered. Have you seen? Well, it's almost down to nothing. But anyway, it was the most beautiful building, and it had lovely things inside. And they had we went in there after we left the train, and my mother didn't know what to do, but someone came over and was bilingual and said that there's a traveler's aid room over here, we'll take you over there. And so we did, and fortunately my father had reported this to the traveler's aid, and he had whatever was to be done with us, and in case anything happened, that he didn't come. So anyway, they put us in a car, which we never had been in before, a car. And we were driven to Quinsigamon, and we came in with a family who were Swedes, and they put us up for the night. It was wonderful. I've never seen them again, it's funny. But they were so gracious to do this for immigrants. And so they put us in, my mother had a bed, and I was on the floor, and my brother was on the floor in another little bed. And for the first time, I didn't have to say, I can't turn around. I had a bed all by myself. Wonderful sleep, but during the night, I could hear this talking, and I woke up, and I could hear my mother talking to my father. And I woke up suddenly. I ran into their bed, and I'm hugging my father, and I'm crying. I'm so thrilled to see my father, because I didn't know what had happened to him. So I'm saying, you know, what happened? Well, the thing that happened was my father was working in some shop, and of course he wasn't that good at knowing the English language, and he didn't make himself understood exactly when we were to arrive or something. So they said that you'll have to work until such and such a time, and so he did just what they said, and when he got on the train, he was an hour late, he didn't make it. He was, we had already left an hour before, but he went down to New York to meet us. So he had arranged to go to another family. This was a widow, a minister's widow, and she had a house that she was trying to hold on to, and she had an upstairs, and she rented this upstairs to my father and us, and it was on West Street. You don't know anything about West Street, but it's a different area. But anyway, we did there, and she, of course, could talk Swedish, so then my mother and she could get together on things. She was old, and we lived there for a while. The one thing that strikes me that's kind of funny was that she couldn't repair the ceilings because she didn't have any, the roof, that she didn't have any money, so there was a leak in the roof. And during the night, one of the nights, my mother woke up and she had dripping into the bed where they slept. And my mother said, you know, it's leaking on the ceiling and that. And she got out her umbrella and she put the umbrella over them, let it run into a pail. See, my mother was very good at knowing what to do at the right time.
That's funny. Well, tell me about Worcester. Well, first of all, what were the things that struck you as real different when you first came?
Oh, when I came, now I went to West Street School. Of course, I enrolled, and my mother and father were very education oriented. They loved teaching and education, and they right off I had to go to school, and so I did. I went to West Street. West Street, even today, it's a lot of blacks, so the school was sort of divided, black and white, and which I wasn't used to at all. That was I didn't want to get near them. I didn't know how to accept them. So anyway, I was put in. I really should have been in the fifth grade according to my age, and I was put into the fifth grade. And I, even though I knew reading and all this stuff, there was nothing. I knew nothing. And I didn't know a word, they said. And I just sat there. And it's not much fun for a young child. And the teacher ignored me more or less because she was, I don't think she was so used to immigrants in that area. And but about the first day that I went there, they're singing music, and the teacher had a stick, and she's saying again, and so then they sang again and again and again, and I opened the desk and I wrote it down like it would be in Swedish again. That was the first word I learned. I couldn't pick up any other word. I came home to my mother and I said, I learned a word again. It wasn't easy. And we moved later, but we didn't stay there too long. My father found through people that in the industry that he worked in that it was much better for us to go up and live on Belmont Hill because there were many Swedes up there, and that was really the right thing to do because we had to get involved with people who knew how to speak to each other, and so we moved to Belmont Hill.
Where was your father working at that point? Do you remember the name of the place?
No, I don't remember, but the thing about my father was that he wanted to work at SKF, and they had a branch in Hartford, Connecticut, and I think it's still there. But when he got there, he was not given anything like he was trained in, and he was a little unhappy. And so he got along with two or three other guys, and they were talking, and they said, you know, in Worcester they pay much more per hour than they do here in this SKF. And so my father says, okay, I'll go there. So he went to Worcester. We thought that we would be living in Hartford because of that SKF thing, but he came to Worcester. That's the ball bearings, you know, the ball bearings and cars and everything. I guess they still use them. I think it's still an industry. But anyway, that's why he came to Worcester. And when he came to Worcester, he never really made it. He never got anything that, and it was during the Depression. There was no work. He'd wake up 5 o'clock in the morning and go from one shop to another trying to get in and couldn't get in. There was nothing. And so, you know, it was, here's a dream. You know, I'm going to go there and have everything. It was a dream that never was fulfilled. It never really was fulfilled in either my mother's or father's life. But, the next generation or their children and the next generation, they profited by it. But they never really got to know that. But anyway, it was very different. Anyway, I went to Belmont Hill, and I went to Belmont Street School. Now, they were more used to immigrants, and they had Swedes and Finns, and they also had a lot of blacks, too, at that time. But anyway, they decided that I should not be in the fifth grade because I had this language difficulty, and they would put me into the third grade. That was two grades below. So I did, and I had this just a fabulous, wonderful teacher whose name was Miss Maroney, and she knew several Swedish words, and every day she'd say, come and sit with me, and she would say a Swedish word, and then she'd say, and this is how we say it, and I would, she says, repeat it and repeat it, so I learned quite a few words. Outside of that, I was really very unhappy because I would stand in the corner in the schoolyard, and the kids would be playing all kinds of hopscotch and everything, and no one would bother with me, and I had no way to communicate with them. So after I had done that for a while, Miss Maroney happened to be out in the schoolyard, and she said, she went over to one of the girls, and she said, I want you to let, by this time I could understand a few things, and she said, I want you to let this little girl play with you. She knows how to play hopscotch. And so they took me in. That was the beginning of me wanting to say anything, because even if I learned a word, I couldn't go along saying again, again all the time. So I did that, and then but I was in the third grade, which was lower than my capacity at that time. But anyway, my father then decided to move further up on the hill because there were more Swedes up there and better housing, you know. And so we did that. We moved many times up on Belmont Hill from one to the other place because of more rooms or more this or, you know, he was always considering his family. My mother and father lived for their children because they had no one else. We were all together. And everything was revolved against with the family. So we moved, and we moved, the last place that we moved was up to Greenhill Park, near Greenhill Park, and it is a beautiful park, and my brother and my sister and I still love everything about Greenhill Park because that's where we spent most of our time, spare time. But anyway, then I went into another school, and then I got involved with another teacher whose name was Miss Carroll, and she was beautiful and wonderful in every way. She wanted to help me so much that it was just perfect. And she knew that I was a good student, and once I got on my feet, I couldn't really pronounce all the words. For a year, I never said anything, just Swedish. But then I started, and I would pronounce the words the English language. There's so many silent letters. In Swedish, you pronounce every letter, and so I would, to myself, I would say the word like I might say it if it was Swedish, pronouncing everything. But when you come to CH, SH, and all this, it's pretty hard. But we had spelling bees. Well, I could spell the words, you know, and I could say the letters, but I sometimes didn't pronounce them right. But I'd stand almost to the end, you know. They were kind of amazed at that, you know. And so, of course, more and more, I learned more and more and more. And in the sixth grade, we had a little graduation at that time, and picked out the top students and sent them to a prep school. Those were in preparation for college or higher education, and we took Latin and French. This was seventh and eighth grade, and I was a candidate. I went to the prep school down at Belmont Street School, and it was very nice. I mean, I got the honor. The thing about that was that that was a sixth grade, and my mother was supposed to come to this little graduation they had, and I didn't want my mother to go. I thought that my mother was so different from all the other mothers that I didn't want her to stick out like something that it wasn't right. I mean, she didn't dress the same or talk. She didn't talk to the people or anything. I was embarrassed. Mm-hmm. How terrible you are at that age. I mean, it's really pathetic. And so I wouldn't let my mother come. And during the graduation, the principal, Mr. Crowley, stood up there when it was time for my diploma, and he spoke out about my accomplishments and how well I did in school, and I had only been here 2 years or something like this, and I was really red in my face, and all I could think of was my mother didn't hear any of it, you know. No one was there for me. So I went to prep school and had a wonderful time there, took French and Latin, and it was very nice. I attribute any of my success, and I think I've had a lot of it, to wonderful teachers. And, well, that's it. Wonderful teachers that give you a little push.
Did your mother and father, given that it was the Depression, did they ever think of going back, or did you ever hear them
talk? Oh, they never had enough money to do any of that, and my mother sewed. She would do my mother worked real, real hard. My father couldn't find a job. My mother went to work. My mother took a job at one point. I don't know, how long do you want this to go?
We'll go about 15 minutes.
Oh, well, anyway, my mother got a job as in a blind person's home, so she was gone 24 hours a day. And I took over the family. I had it all my life. She worked at that. They had to make a living. We had no one to turn to. We had to shift for ourselves. My father would keep the house sometimes, and he would be running for jobs all the time, and he struggled, and I don't imagine that he was very happy about what went on in his life. And my mother never complained, but my mother worked all the time. And I did too. I started working when I was 14. I went in, and my mother was working for a dentist. She was washing the bibs that you had. She got a penny a piece for washing a bib, and then she cleaned the floors. And that dentist said if my mother wanted me to work. I could get a job at his place, so she said, sure. I was 14. I went to prep, and I got off at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so every afternoon I went to the dentist and worked there, cleaned the instruments, put the bib on, all this stuff. You know, I didn't know too much about anything, but it was the beginning of my work period, and that was the reason why I felt after I had been there a while that I wanted to go into nursing, and I had to do that. I wanted to get in. I did that for 2 or 3 years, and then I decided I wanted to go into nursing. The strange part about that was in order to go into nursing at 18, I was just 17 and a half. I had only done a year and a half of high school because I was 2 years behind my age. And so I only had a year and a half of high school, and I quit high school. And a friend of ours who was a nurse, we went everywhere making applications for nurses' schools, and no one would take me because I only had a year and a half of high school. At that time, they were taking students at Worcester State, and Worcester State Mental. And so I applied there, and it was really a wonderful thing because I was making $10, a little over $10 a week working there. We were like cheap labor, but we also got a wonderful training. And so I immediately went there, but I only had a year and a half of high school, which was all right because I did very well in training. We started with 60 students, and when we graduated, there was only 11 left. And because it's a really hard work, and 2,000 to 3,000 patients. And so, you know, it was a big place and everything, but I folded in very well and did all right. Sometimes I would come home to my mother and I'd say, I can't stand it, I gotta get home, I can't be here anymore. And my mother said, sit down, we'll have a little supper, and then you sleep and maybe you'll feel better in the morning. And that's what happened every time it happened. I felt better in the morning and I went right back.
Was Worcester Mental?
Yeah, said? Worcester State Hospital. I don't know if you know where it is, but of course it's in existence still. It's not as big. It's where University of Massachusetts Medical School is. It's right up on the hill there, and they owned all that land. I was there at that time, you know, when they owned all that land, and they had farms and all this stuff. It was a very interesting thing, and I learned an awful lot there. But anyway, I graduated from there, and I got the highest score. And so the alumni offered me a scholarship to go into teaching, take a course into teaching, but I was too shy. I couldn't stand teaching. And so I decided I want to go into surgery. One of the things was I had an awful lot of acne. I also had little dental things, teeth that weren't that great, so I never was proud of myself, my looks. At that age, you want to look good. So in surgery, you put mask on and you don't see the face. So I got into that and I got very involved with the supervisor there, and I loved surgery. And so I wanted to go to Johns Hopkins and take a course in surgery there. That's what I wanted to specialize in. And so when I applied there, they would not accept me because I only had a year and a half of high school, even though I was on top of my class. And so I decided to go back to get my high school. I went to Northeastern University nights while I was working nights for a year and a half. to get my high school diploma, which I did. And when I did that and applied at Johns Hopkins, they accepted me. And so I took a course there. I was mainly interested in that because they gave some brain surgery. That's what I wanted to be in at Worcester State. I wanted to go back to Worcester State and give them some of my labor there. And so we were just setting up brain surgery for lobotomies and stuff, and which I got in after I got through my course. And so I did that for, I don't know how long it was, a while. I was a supervisor there. The supervisor that I was very friendly with died of pneumonia. She got pneumonia. There was no drugs. She died. She was only 30 years old. So then I became the supervisor there, and I set up the helped the surgeon set up the instruments and things for that, and did that for a while. And we also had all kinds of surgery. When you get 2,000 or 3,000 people, you have all kinds of surgeries, you know. So we were a busy surgery, and we had a lot of clinic. We were working very hard with syphilis. We had a big syphilis clinic with spinals and blood work and all this stuff. So it was a wonderful experience, and I loved it. So then, I just want to make this quickly, I guess. So then I got through with that, and of course I fell in love and got married and had three children, three sons.
Who did you marry?
Well, his name was Carlo Carlson, Carl Oscar Carlson. And so we...
How did you meet your husband?
I met my husband at a dance.
Is he also Swedish?
Yeah, that's the reason why we connected, because he asked me to dance, and when he asked me my name, and I told him, then he said, "You're a Swede?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm a Swede." And he didn't look like a Swede, because he had kind of brownish eyes and kind of darkish hair, you know, and I was kind of blonde. And so he said, "You're a Swede." And I said, "Yeah." And so he says, "I am too." And I said, "You are?" And so then he... then he says, "Oh," he says, "can I take you home?" Well, I said, "I have a girlfriend with me." "Well, we'll take her home, and then I'll take you home." And I got out in his car, and my father never had a car. We never rode in a car. I knew nothing about cars. It was always street cars, you know. And so then I got into his car, and it was a gray Auburn with red trimmings. And I got in there, and it was immaculately clean. And I was so taken up by this. Here's a guy that looks so nice, you know, suit, tie, and this. And I had been trying to get someone to go to a dance because I was kind of active in my profession. We had dances, and I never could find anyone that had a suit or that wanted to go to a dance. And so I said, "We're having a dance. Would you like to go to this dance?" And at the Bancroft Hotel. And he says, "Sure." And so that was how we began. And of course, now when I got to his house, his people were just as excited as mine were about two Swedes getting together. It was the Swedes that did it. So I have I have three sons, and they are 100% Swedes, because both the mother and father were Swedes. And so
what are their names, your children?
The oldest one is Roger Emil, from his grandfather, and the next one is Paul Gustav, and Gustav was my father's name, and the next one is Dennis Allen. And so anyway, we got settled, and and even before we got married, we were sort of engaged, and I was supposed to go to Johns Hopkins, and my husband-to-be said, "You go. You've been wanting to do this all your life. You go." And so I did. I left him and went and took that, and I'm glad I did. And so then when I
how long were you gone?
No, I was gone like 4 months or something like that. Of course, that's a long time when you're in love, you know. So my oldest one especially was getting very good marks in school, all A's and everything, and I kind of thought that he would want to go into college, and you know, he had it. And so when my youngest one, Denny, was 5 years old, I decided to, my neighbor asked me if I'd like to go up to Worcester County Hospital and do a night job there, relieving nurses who wanted a night off. And I said, well, I haven't done anything for 10 years. I don't know. And she said, oh, I'll show you when you'll be all right. I went up there and did some night work now and then and left my family. And so then after a while, after I had been there a little while, there was an opening in the surgery, and they found out that, you know, I was specialized in surgery. So I went into TB nursing and TB surgery, and there was an opening in the surgery, and I worked there until I was 60 years old, and I was delighted with my job, and I had done brain surgery. Now we were doing lung surgery and tuberculosis, and we were resecting lungs, taking out portions of lungs or lobes of lungs where there was TB, and a wonderful, wonderful surgeon that came from this area, and a very active work. And then suddenly we found that there was medication for TB, INH, and so the surgery was quieted down. We didn't have very much, so they were sort of thinking about not having the surgery. And so I went into clinic work, and that was skin testing and that kind of clinic work that you do in TB. I guess it's starting all over again, but at that time it was quite active, and I enjoyed that. I had to meet a lot of people and a lot of tests and x-rays and stuff like this. I was interested. So I really specialized in both brain and lungs, and you know, it helped me a lot in my life.
What are you most proud of that you've achieved or accomplished in your life?
Well, I was proud of what I did. My brother also, he came home telling my mother that he had a scholarship to Clark University, and my mother said, what does that mean? She didn't know anything about it. That's how, you know, she didn't understand what went on in education. And so she said, you might as well do it, because there aren't any jobs. This was during the Depression. So my brother graduated from Clark University and on scholarship, and he went into the service he was in Coast Guard as a lieutenant, and then he went into Wayne State University and worked in the admission, was the assistant admission officer there for many years and retired from there. So he accomplished something. I was proud of what I did. My mother and father, I'll tell you, any graduation that I had after that same one experience, my mother and father were there, because by that time I had gotten mature enough to know that. So when I graduated from training and I got an award, my mother and father were just gloating over me. And I'm proud of my accomplishments. I think I worked very hard. I didn't really date very much through this thing until I was all through training and I had a job, so I had my feet on the ground. I wish the same for my granddaughters, but it's hard. But then I was very proud of my sons also. My oldest son, he's he graduated from Worcester Tech, and he's a design engineer, and he started his own company. He has a lot of problems right now, but I mean, he did that, and he, you know, I'm proud of that.
Did you get over feeling insecure about, you know, you mentioned when you went into surgery so you could cover your
face?
Yeah,
I know. I was a very shy person anyway, and I think all of this experience of not being able to communicate and all this stuff didn't do me any good, because I was really a blushing, you know how blondes can get, my whole face would get red, and everybody wanted to use that so that they'd always be doing something to me to watch me blush. That's not a nice thing to do, but anyway, after I was married and had my children and that, I became quite outgoing, as you can hear. You know, I mean, I had more confidence, or, well, as I went on in my employment. One thing about being shy and all that, it almost seemed as if I had two personalities, because when I'd go visit somebody, I would be very shy. I would not participate in the conversation or anything, but when I was professionally, I was like another person. I could talk very freely, and I talked to the physicians, and you know, I felt confident then. So it was like almost like being two different people.
What about this phase of your life? How do you feel about your life at this
time? Well, my life now is the saddest that I've had in my whole life, because of the loss of my husband, and I live alone, and my sons are all married. They're very good to me, but they all have their own problems and activities, and the one thing that I probably miss that some people have, they had church connections where they were very active. I did not have that in my life. Neither my husband nor I ever attended. We never belonged to a church, even though I sent my children. My mother also sent me to confirmation and said, I want you to have this knowledge. You can do whatever you want in your life. I'm not saying that you do or you don't. You do whatever you wish. And I brought up my children the same way, my sons. You can do anything you want. If you want to go to church, if you don't, it's perfectly all right with me. You don't have to please me in any way. And so right now I am connected to the people's church. They have a group there, and we take little trips in that. And I did go with my brother and his wife to Scandinavia, and I crossed the country with them from Detroit to California. He lives in California 6 months, and in Canada 6 months, so they cross a lot. He wanted me to see the country. He knows that I'm interested in this stuff, so we went everywhere and visited Indians and everything all the way across. So, you know, I've had a little travel, and not only that, my husband and I took a trip to Scandinavia for 7 weeks, and we bought a Volvo, and we traveled all over the countries there and visited all our relatives and all this. So, and we went many places, and of course I miss all that, but I mainly miss my husband. He was 79, which, you know, a good age, but, and he had been sick for about 10 years with a heart condition, and I took care of him, oxygen, running to the hospital, bringing him up there. He had like 5 or 6 coronaries. It was difficult, but he was there. But now he's not there.
When did you go on the elder house?
Last June, a year ago. And we went for the 3 weeks with the Elder Hostel. Then we went back to Sweden, and we visited with my cousin, and we rented a car, and we drove everywhere. My brother did very, very well. He was 72. I'm 80 now, and he's going to be 73. But we did very well, and the traffic there and the country there is, the cities, it's just as difficult as it is here.
Well, tell me, before we close, tell me about the fact of starting out in Sweden and then living most of your life here. What effect do you think it's had on you and your life being Swedish and starting out in Sweden and then becoming American?
Well, I'm proud of being Swedish. I think that my mother and father's children, my brother, my sister, and I had many more opportunities than we would have had if we lived in Sweden. Although when we visited there, they have a wonderful education and wonderful health caring and education. They are into education, real, much more than we are. And so I don't know whether we would have been as well off, but I think that we are all happy that we had that opportunity. So maybe it was a wise choice for us, but it was not for my mother and father. It was too difficult for them. So, you know, it almost takes a lifetime to be able to do that, I mean I'm not unhappy that I'm here, and I'm sure my kids would, or my children and my grandchildren, that they would say, oh no, I'd never want to go to Sweden. I'd never want to live there.
Well, is there anything else that you can think of regarding coming here?
The other thing that I didn't mention, and I've mentioned it very few times in my life, was that when we came here up to Belmont Hill, my folks were still very lonely in that, and they had formed a group. The Communist Party was active on Belmont Hill, and they had rented a hall, and they also bought land out in the country in Auburn. Because they wanted to form this Communist Party. When I look back at that, it was not really anything that had to do with communism. It was more a social thing, and it was that these Scandinavians, there were a lot of Finns in there too. It was more or less for them to be together, and they worked very hard doing this, and they would have dinners, and my mother would always be in the kitchen, and she'd always be making donuts, and they'd always be selling these things, and everybody looked forward to the meetings that they had and the activity that they had. Now, because we were not church members or church-oriented, we didn't have anything like that. So that was a very good thing for that particular time. When I went into training at that time, they all had already, we were talking at so much about anti-communism, and that seemed to be a real topic. And my mother and father were a little bit afraid that it would hamper our learning or our education and all that, so they decided to stop going. And they did, but it didn't take too long after that the whole thing dissolved. But they would have, in this Woodland Park in Auburn, where they put up a dance hall and a picnic area where the kids would be going in the summertime for picnics and things. They had a wonderful time dancing every Saturday night, and that was a thing. I mean, there wasn't that much communists or what the communists were doing, and so it didn't. But still, if you lived in an area where most of the Scandinavians were going to church, because they had come here many years ago and they were very religious, which they are even today, then then you felt sort of on the outside, and you could not associate with them. And so served the purpose of having friends and getting together and having fun. That's really what all I can think of at Woodland Park is having fun. And my mother and father, they would have missed it terribly if they had not had it. And but once we got going and my father got more active in some job or something, and my mother, she was working up to the end almost anyway, then you know, they could take that they didn't have to go, and then it just kind of dissolved. Well, that's kind of interesting.
And then when was that as far as the McCarthy era?
I can't remember, I can't connect it with that, but let's see, it was when I went into training, and so I was like 18 years old. And see, I was 18 years old. I was born in 13, 8, 9, 10, 11.
32.
Yeah, well, it was like 30. I would say like 30, 1930, because I was not doing this, and I never went. Once I went training, I was too busy. I just never, and they didn't go that much either. And then it was never. Anyway, it wasn't existing. They did have dances a long time after, but I don't think that they had any kind of connection or any kind of club. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, the Finns and the Swedes. And it's funny, the Finns and the Swedes, the Finns would sit on one side and the Swedes would sit on the other, you know, as if they were different. Now, when I went on my trip and I heard the history about Finland, I didn't even want to say I was a Swede, because when I heard what the Swedes did to the Finns, trying to get their land and creating this war that they had, it's shameful. Not only that, then the Finns had Russia. Russia did the same thing. They wanted the land, so they were trying to steal the land. So they had another civil war over that, and the Finns did nothing but war and work and work. And Finland was the most beautiful country, and now I had Finnish friends also when I grew up, but the Swedes and the Finns were separate for some, maybe because of this civil war, but anyway.
Okay, well, the tape is about to run out, and I want to say this has been just delightful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I don't know who's going to hear this.
Well, I'll tell you. But let me just say, I've been speaking with Gurli Carlson, and she came from Sweden in 1923 at the age of 11 and has been here in Worcester, essentially.